Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with William D. Godsey about his study of the fiscal role of the estates of Lower Austria in the Habsburg Empire during the early modern era, entitled The Sinews of Habsburg Power, Lower Austria in a Fiscal Military State, 1650 to 1820. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I'm an American scholar born in Tennessee and have been living in Europe since the middle of the 1990s and am currently a senior research fellow of the Austrian Academy of Sciences in Vienna.
As in your capacity, do you do teaching or is it mostly a research position?
My position is a research position, but I did a Habilitation, is what it's called in German, about 10 years ago at the University of Vienna, which means that I have the right. The system is a little different than in the Anglo-Saxon world, if you have your PhD, then you're qualified to teach at a university. Here, you're supposed to do Habilitation. Now, I have my PhD from the University of Virginia, so I have an American PhD. But here, you're supposed to have a Habilitation in order to teach at the university. And so I did that. I went through that process, which it basically means you need a second book. to teach, and that's what you need in America too. And so I handed in my second book to the University of Vienna, and they approved it as Habilitation. And so I do teach now and again, but not very often.
What was it that led you to write this book?
That was a combination of things. On the one hand, the research focus of my institute on the Habsburg monarchy and the particularly this the early modern period, but also the question of the way that the Habsburg monarchy has been changing in our perceptions over the last 20 years, the way historians have been changing our perceptions of the Habsburg monarchy, which used to be viewed as a very brittle entity. Historians, I would say half century ago, portrayed the monarchy as practically in decline from the 18th century down then to the collapse of the monarchy in 1918. This date in 1918 is so important in the way people think about Habsburg history, because this great empire that existed for hundreds of years in European history and was an important player suddenly disappeared. And so historians after 1918 were looking at the reasons for its collapse and tracing the background of its collapse. And in the last 20 years, historians have changed, and historians have been looking at what made this empire work for so long. And that was one of the questions, that was the major question behind my book. How did this empire function in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries?
So your book focuses upon one institution of this empire, and that is the estates of Lower Austria. I wonder if you could start us off by explaining what the estates were and why their location in Lower Austria was so important and worth focusing on.
Okay, well, let's think about what the Habsburg monarchy was, how it was put together. It was a composite monarchy, which means it was made up of individual territories, each of which had its own political identity, and there were representative institutions in each of these territories, and the Habsburg dynasty, the ruling family of this monarchy, ruled each of these territories under a particular title. And As I say, there were representative institutions in each territory, diets, or I don't want to use the word a legislature. I don't think that's that would be the best comparison. But estates, they were in English, you say estates, who were called together on a regular basis to approve taxes and other requests by the ruler each year. And the estates were composed of nobles and prelates and burghers or town or townsmen. So there were three or four estates in these institutions.
I thought it was interesting the way you described it in the book was that these estates were not static. That you had these at the beginning, you talked about the four estates, and I thought that was interesting because for people who might be familiar with France and during the French Revolution, you have the three estates: the clergy, the nobility, and you know the commoners, so to speak. And right. How in Lower Austria it was these four estates, and how. And how over this period the composition of them, the numbers, the role does not remain static. They actually fluctuate, and that forms part of your analysis of the role that they played.
That's right. The system was comparable to what you just said was the structure in France. There were basically three estates, but in Lower Austria and in other Habsburg lands, the nobility was divided up into two estates, and so you had one organization or one curia, that's the word I used in the book, one estate for lords, the upper nobility, and one estate for the knights, and then there was an estate of prelates and an estate of the townsmen, and the estates fluctuated in numbers and in quality or composition over time. The estate of knights declined over the course of the period that I deal with. The estate of lords became ever more important and ever more powerful. The lords increased in number, the knights decreased in number. The estate of the clergy, the estate of the clergy, or the estate of prelates, as they were called, remained about up until the reign of Joseph II, remained pretty static in terms of its membership. I guess we'll come back to the question of Joseph II later in the interview. But the estate of prelates lost about half of its members in the 1780s through the reforms.
And the
fourth estate, the estate of townsmen, was the early modern towns in Austria from starting in the 16th century were in decline, and most of them were so poor that they couldn't even pay their part of the taxes that the diets approved each year, and so they played a marginal role in the estates. They weren't represented in the major committees, for example.
You've described the structure of the estates. What role did they play in terms of the functioning of the Habsburg Empire as a European power during this period?
Okay, I guess one way to get into this question would be to think what early modern states did. What were the and maybe to compare them to what modern states do? What did early modern states do? And they had basically three major areas of activity: the fiscal extraction, in order basically raising taxes. The second area is public order and justice, and the third area is the maintenance of an army. So basically, external defense and maintaining domestic order. So these were the activities of early modern states, and many or all basically early modern states were not, did not have a bureaucracy that helped them to undertake these activities. And they needed the support basically of local society. And there were these estates that existed in every territory that were located at the intersection, I would say, at the intersection of government and society. They were the representatives of local society, basically the people who in local society who were had control of resources, and the estates, because they were organized, they had organizations, they were standing committees in the main cities or in the capital cities of the individual provinces, and had other ways of had other means of setting up administrative structures. I'm thinking in German again. I'm talking in English.
No worries.
Of setting up administrative structures that would enable government to function. I don't know whether I've answered the question.
I think you have. These institutions, as I the estates, as you've explained, were very important in terms of providing government for Lower Austria, this region of the empire, which, as you explain in the book, was an important region economically, but was one in decline at a time when, as you explain, the state, is starting to place greater demands, fiscal demands, upon the structure of the fiscal structure to support their army as they're engaged in expansion and defense.
That's right. And why, you asked me a minute ago, you asked me why Lower Austria. Lower Austria was a central, geographically, fiscally, and politically, a central territory of the Habsburg monarchy. Vienna was the residence of the Habsburg rulers. Vienna is the capital of Lower Austria. Lower Austria lies at the center of this composite monarchy that I mentioned a minute ago, that consisted of the Bohemian lands, of the Hungarian lands, of the Austrian duchies, and of the Austrian lands. Of course, the Habsburg monarchy was composed. I think today people, when they think about the Habsburg monarchy, they think about the specifically Central European monarchy that existed in the late 19th century. But the Habsburg monarchy in the early modern period was sort of composed of various collections of territories. As I say, the Bohemian ones, the Austrian ones, the Hungarian ones, but there were also the territories in the southern Netherlands. The Habsburgs had territories in northern Italy. The Habsburgs, we should also remember, were emperors of the Holy Roman Empire. But the Habsburg, the dynasty, its center was in Vienna, and Vienna was the capital of Lower Austria, and this was the reason that I chose this territory to see. It provided insight into the way the dynasty dealt with the estates in one of its territories. These estates were, the Habsburgs had regular contact with the estates of Lower Austria in a way they didn't have with any of the other estates. I mean, lots of people know that Maria Theresa went to visit the Hungarian Diet in the early 1740s when she came to the throne to plead for existence. But the Habsburg rulers had yearly contact with the estates in Lower Austria, and so I thought this provided exceptional insight into the relationship between the center of Habsburg power and provincial power, which is the question I'm dealing with in this book.
What you describe over the course of it, as I was reading it, was the idea that it was this evolving in a certain direction, and yet as you explained, the evolution was not linear. It wasn't as though it was all about centralization and that you end the book with, you know, a stronger central government and the estates is irrelevant. It's not necessarily a guaranteed thing. But you do point out from the beginning, when you're talking about the middle of the 17th century, how there are already these trends in place, these demands upon Habsburg power that necessitate changes to the relationship between the estates and the central monarchy. Could you elaborate a bit upon what some of those pressures were that you describe and how the estates responded to them with their structure in the 17th century?
Sure. Well, let's think about what was going on in the middle of the 17th century. You have the end of the 30 Years' War. And at the end of the 30 Years' War, the situation was still so uncertain that the Habsburg Emperor, or the Emperor, we should call him from the House of Habsburg, decided he needed to maintain a standing army. And this had not been the case in after earlier conflicts. The army had basically been disbanded. And the pressure to maintain it had declined after the end of an armed conflict. But suddenly, for the first time in Habsburg history, you have in the middle of the 18th, or the middle of the 17th century, 1648, 1650, you have this decision to maintain a standing army, to keep a standing army in peacetime. And so you have to maintain that. Where is it going to be housed? Who's going to pay the salaries for these? For these soldiers, who's going to feed them, et cetera. And the army over the beginning in 1650, the army then increases in size over the next basically 170 years, increases irregularly in size, not regularly in size, but irregularly in size. From the 1670s, the Habsburgs are at war with France, the France of Louis XIV, and with the and then from the 1680s with the Ottoman Empire, basically war on two fronts, and so the size of the army is increasing, and by the early 18th century, you had a standing army of around 30,000 people around 1650. You have by the first years of the 18th century, you already have 100,000, an army of 100,000 men that has to be maintained. And this increases over the 18th century. Then there are various wars in the 18th century, the War of the Spanish Succession at the beginning of the century, and then a couple of Ottoman wars again in the first decades of the 18th century. Then you have the War of the Austrian Succession, and by the time you get up to the period just before the French Revolution, you have the Habsburgs have an army of 300,000 men. It's tripled over the size of the 18th century and is 10 times the size of what was the army after the 30 Years' War, 140 years earlier. So you have these soldiers have to be fed, they have to be housed, they have to be paid, they have to be moved around, and who's going to do this? And the central authorities in the Habsburg monarchy don't have the resources themselves to undertake this activity, and they basically need the help of local society, and there's all sorts of pressure from above on the provinces, on the various territories that made up the Habsburg monarchy, to maintain this standing army. And that means going to the diets, requesting money, going to the diets, asking them to set up administrative structures to take care of these soldiers. That's, I think you mentioned the commissariat, didn't you?
Yeah, you were going to describe, you described the commissariat when it's set in the 18th century as being one such institution.
Right. In the 17th century, sort of toward the end of the 30 Years' War, a commissariat comes into being in Lower Austria, set up by the estates to look after the Habsburg army when it's on Lower Austrian territory, and the various territories in the Habsburg monarchy develop develop similar structures. The one here was the one in the commissariat in Lower Austria that was maintained by the estates, was maintained by, was an administrative structure in the sense that the estates employed people from outside to do this sort of work. The estates themselves undertook this work. So the main commissarial positions were reserved to nobles and also at first clergy. So you even have prelates or abbots from some of the monasteries here guiding soldiers through the countryside. These soldiers, when Habsburg troops reached the borders of this province, they had to be guided through the province so that the settlements and rural people were would be as little affected as possible. I mean, you have to remember what that meant in the early modern period when a regiment of soldiers arrived in a village, how terrifying that can be, and what damage could ensue if it weren't done in an organized way. The food would be stolen, money would be stolen, all kinds of violence was also possible. So these structures were set up at the request of the central government by the provincial authorities as embodied by the estates to try to organize this activity as well as possible.
And not just organize it, but finance it as well, correct?
That's right. Also to finance it. So the estates are being asked at the yearly diet, as I said, the four estates then come together at a yearly meeting that could last several months, and financial demands are made by the central authorities on the diets. A request for money, also for loans. The estates are a credit institution. This is something that plays a really important part in my book. Are providing loans to the ruler, the estates, members of the estates themselves loan money to the corporation of the estates, which then loans money to the central government. The estates are responsible for tax collection, for the imposition and tax collection. The amount that they guarantee to the ruler, they then have to raise themselves through the tax structures. And these were the manorial. The estates supervise the manorial structures in the countryside. The manorial structures and the village structures in the countryside took in at the most basic level, at the lowest level, took in the money that was imposed on them, and then sent it to the estates in Vienna, who then passed it on to the central government. That's the way the administrative structure at that time it worked. And so the central government was able to save money, if you will, by not having set up its own structures in the countryside to undertake all of this work. It would have been enormously expensive.
And yet that, like so many things in life, comes at a price, and the price is that they have to be more cooperative, correct?
Right. The estates were pulled into a system with which they weren't always satisfied, but it was either they play this game or they disappear because they would have had a privileged position without basically paying for it. So their privilege was based on this cooperation. As long as they participated in government, their privileged position was secured, if you will. That's the best way to put it. As long as they participated in fiscal extraction, as long as they helped organize the standing army when it was passing through Lower Austria or was billeted here, their privileged position in society was relatively secure.
In your book, you describe the evolution of this process over the 17th century into the 18th century, and it seems that by the 18th century, this new process has been negotiated out, and it just at that point you start to see the amounts being requested increasing. You describe, for example, how with the War of Polish Succession, the War of Austrian Succession, Austrian state finds itself in a state of constant war, not the total war of the 19th and 20th centuries, but a war which puts fiscal demands this regular fiscal demand upon the Habsburg state.
The estates had, this was a process that had already begun in the later 17th century, where the estates began to guarantee certain amounts of money to the central government in agreements that were signed every few years. And one of the purposes of these agreements was to secure the credit activity of the estates that they were also undertaking on behalf of the central government. The estates would not only provide free money or tax money to the central government, they would supply credit to the central government, and the sum that they approved at the Diet each year was basically the guarantee that the credit they had taken out under their own name would be paid out, and these sums were constantly increasing over the course of the later 17th and 18th centuries, and by around during the War of the Austrian Succession that you mentioned, the amount had if we go back to the to the period around 1650, when the standing army first came into being, the sum that was approved by the Diet was around 100,000 florins per year, and by the early 1740s or by the mid 1740s, let's say, it had climbed to 2 million florins a year.
How did Lower Austria afford that? Because you're describing that alongside this, it's a region in which you have occasional fighting, which is economically disruptive, but it's also a region in which a lot of their traditional products are no longer as profitable. You describe a region that economically is not thriving in the way that other regions of Europe are during that time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, certainly Lower Austria was not Western Europe, the Netherlands or France or Great Britain in terms of economic activity. A lot of economic activity in Austria was doesn't occur to me I wouldn't want to paint the situation in Lower Austria too dark. I mean, the situation had improved after the by the early 18th century. The economy had recovered somewhat from the 30 Years' War. There was more trade. Textile production in Lower Austria by the 18th century. There was a certain amount of economic activity that would support the sums that were approved by the Diet each year.
So you have this description over the course of your book of this effort to respond to the demands of that are being placed upon the Habsburg state in the 17th and 18th century, and it seems to be a largely successful story. And then you get to 1780, and then you have the accession of Joseph II, and you describe this period of very dramatic change. I was wondering if you could explain. Was that a success deceptive, or was it an effort to try to dramatically change things in order to accommodate other issues?
Right. If you wouldn't mind if I go back for a minute to the reign of Maria Theresa, after the you have basically an existential crisis in the Habsburg monarchy with the accession of young Maria Theresa in 1740. She there had been a certain amount of malaise in government in the last 10 years of her father's reign. So in the 1730s, there were two basically lost wars, the War of the Polish Succession and the War of the Ottoman War at the end of the 1730s, in which the fortress of Belgrade, which Prince Eugen had conquered only 20 years earlier, was lost again. Then she comes to the throne in 1740 and is attacked by Frederick II, is involved of Prussia, for the person that's often called Frederick the Great. So she is... she is confronted by this major challenge, and what is her what does she do in order to meet this challenge? How do you meet this this difficult situation? And her decision was that the army would be placed at a certain level, that the there would be, I think it was 107 or 108,000 troops, that there would be a standing army of more than 100,000 troops maintained after the Seven Years' War, and her principal minister at that time, Haugwitz, negotiated with the estates of the Bohemian and Austrian lands, basically renegotiated the tax agreement to guarantee sums that would support this army, and basically, and this was new, basically placed the wartime, made wartime taxation a peacetime a permanent aspect of peacetime, much like the standing army had been introduced in the middle of the 17th century as a peacetime institution. So Maria Theresa had already undertaken very important reforms, including this fixing taxation at a peacetime level. And then she gets involved in the Seven Years' War, which becomes the most expensive war, a disastrously expensive war in the history of the Habsburg monarchy up until that time. And how does she finance that war? Well, I mean, these agreements that she's concluded with the estates at the end of the 1740s, she had set the new taxation at a wartime level, and at the same time had told the estates, "I want increased taxation, or I will not increase my demands on the Diet because this new peacetime demand is so high." For the space of 10 years, basically. And then she goes to war before the 10 years are even up. And is bound by these agreements. So how does she raise the money to do it? And what she does is she starts borrowing, and she borrows through the estates. This is when the estates really come into their own, and where they play, where I would say the quality of the relationship between the central government and the estates changes in the most important way during the 18th century, because Maria Theresa borrows millions and millions and millions of florins through the estates. So she's not only getting taxation from them, but she's borrowing large sums from them. And the monarchy could not have sustained the war effort over seven years without this credit that's being provided by the estates. And at the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763, Joseph II, whom you just mentioned, and I'm coming back to him, Joseph II was a young man at that point, had basically come of age, and the signs are that he was outraged by the fact that the monarchy was so dependent on the estates for. Had become so dependent on them through their credit activity.
He's very famous in sort of the conception of the 18th century as being one of these enlightened absolutists or enlightened despots,
right?
Or, various labels that
exactly
that yeah. discredit. But he definitely has a very different view of the role of the emperor and the role of the central state than his predecessors have.
That's right. Joseph was differed from both his predecessors, all of his predecessors, and also his immediate successors in his approach to government. He was interested in the creation of a rationalized, unified monarchy in which these various traditional institutions did not play a significant role. And he was definitely anti-estates in terms of his approach to government. And but when he came to, and this is what maybe one of the things that most surprised me when I was doing the research for this book, is that when he came to the throne in 1780, and if you look back at the historical literature on the Habsburg monarchy, you often read that Joseph did not convoke the estates while he was on the throne. And he certainly reformed, and this is quite well known, he abolished a lot of monasteries. And this affected the composition of the estates. So as I mentioned beginning of the interview, about half of the members of the estate of clergy of the lower Austrian estates disappeared during this period because he abolished monasteries. So his reforms certainly did affect the estates. But if you read the literature, and this is what I found so fascinating, that he did not convoke what's often said, he did not convoke the diets. He did not convoke the estates in his central lands, in his Bohemian and Austrian lands during his reign. And he certainly didn't convoke the diet in Hungary while he was on the throne. And so I discovered in Lower Austria that that he did, by looking at the records, going to the archives, and looking at the records, that he in fact did convoke the diet in Lower Austria every year during his reign. And I thought, well, if he did it in Lower Austria, he may have done it in other places too, where we think the estates have disappeared or have vanished because of the reform activity. And so I went around to, and this is where my book is really comparative, I went around and looked to the archives and the other provincial in the archives of the other Habsburg provinces, Bohemia and Carniola and Carinthia and Styria and Upper Austria, and looked to see, you know, is he convoking the estates there during his reign? And discovered that he called the estates together every year throughout his reign, all the way down to he died in February of 1790, and the diets were all convoked in the fall of 1789, which had been the practice up to then, to convoke the diets each year in the fall. And so he was certainly no friend of the estates, but he was forced to convoke them because of their credit activity. That's the explanation for that. The state debt, if you will, as I mentioned a minute ago, during the Seven Years' War, the government had been borrowing lots and lots of money through the estates, and this money had to be paid back. And there was and because the estates had been borrowing on behalf of the government, these estates institutions and the central government were so closely interconnected that you could hardly, you know, you couldn't take them apart if one collapsed, the other would collapse practically. And so he had to convoke the estates because the fact that they came together was a sign to the people who held the bonds that were issued by the estates that they would be paid back.
One of the things I thought was very interesting was how you describe that when he takes the throne in 1780, he forgoes some of the important rituals that reaffirmed his obligations to his subjects, specifically the power groups in the various estates, and how when his brother Leopold takes over in 1790, and then of course when he's followed by Francis, that they go back to that, and it seems to be almost something of a repair activity, and it speaks to the endurance of the estates in terms of their importance.
Yeah, that's right. That was another way. That was another way in which Joseph differed from both his mother, Maria Theresa, and also from his brother and his nephew, Leopold II and Francis II, that he didn't. He refused to go through these inaugural rites, these coronation ceremonies. In the 18th century, in the later 18th century, the ones in the major lands of the Habsburg monarchy survived, and this was a sign that the Habsburg monarchy was a composite monarchy, basically made up of separate territories, and the coronation in Bohemia in Prague had survived, and the Kingdom of Bohemia proper had survived, the coronation in Hungary had survived, and also what's called the Ehrpuldigung, this is the German term, the act of homage in Lower Austria, had survived, and it was usually the very first ceremony that Austrian rulers underwent when they came to the throne was the so-called act of homage in Vienna, when the estates gathered in the Habsburg Palace here in downtown Vienna, and there were all sorts of ceremonies that were associated with that, and took an oath of homage to the Habsburg ruler in exchange for a guarantee of what was called the estates constitution, which was basically the political constitution of the territory. You have to remember, in the early modern period, you didn't have written constitutions that guaranteed the written order. The constitutional order was established through these kinds of ceremonies, and Joseph wanted to reform, and he didn't want to be bound by the conventions that such ceremonies imposed on him, and so he refused to submit to these ceremonies. He wasn't crowned anywhere. He had the Bohemian crown, the Hungarian crown, and also the in Lower Austria there's no crown. It's called the Archducal hat, and he had these various artifacts taken from their places of safekeeping. The one in Lower Austria was always kept in the Abbey of Klosterneuburg, which is a big abbey just north of the city here on the Danube River. And he had them all placed in his treasury here in Vienna, and said, "I'm not gonna participate in these ceremonies," because he didn't say it, but it was because they placed restraints on his power. And he rejected these restraints until he had reformed the monarchy in the way he thought that should be done. Now the problem with this is that toward the end of Joseph's reign, there were in the southern Netherlands, for example, he also implemented reforms there in the southern Netherlands, and he abolished, in response to opposition there, he abolished what he called the estates constitution in the province of Brabant in the southern Netherlands, and this provoked a rebellion. And so Joseph is strengthening the monarchy, but he's also weakening it by attacking these elites on which the monarchy is dependent. And you have a certain amount of unrest in Hungary, and even the Lower Austrian estates. The concatenation of interests, if you will, between the monarchy and the estates in the various central lands, including Lower Austria, was much closer than, say, between the monarchy and the elites in the southern Netherlands or in Hungary. But even here, there's a high level of dissatisfaction by the time that Joseph dies. And when Leopold then comes to the throne, his brother, who was also a very enlightened ruler, Leopold realized that, and this was something also that I found quite fascinating, that Leopold and also Maria Theresa had understood this as well, that if you have such high levels of fiscal exaction, there has to be a way, taxes being taken from people, you have recruits being taken from local from villages and from local society, and you also have to have a way for these things to be legitimated. And one way of legitimating them, for this activity to be legitimated, is for these diets to come together each year, for the estates to meet each year, and to approve the tax requests. Yeah, I see even connections to American history in the later 18th century. You have during the Seven Years' War, the imposition of taxes by the British Parliament on Americans without asking for their approval. And this was also what was going on in the Habsburg monarchy, in certain places at least. And it caused problems at the end of his reign. And then Leopold came to the throne, and he recalled the estates or was crowned in Bohemia and Hungary. He underwent the very first thing he did when he arrived. He'd been Grand Duke in Tuscany. That had been his area while his brother was emperor. He had been Grand Duke down in Tuscany, and he came back to Vienna. He arrived here, I think, on the 12th of March, and he already underwent the act of homage in Vienna on April 6th. So very, very quickly. And this sent a sign out to the entire Habsburg monarchy. It was heard everywhere that he was going to rule according to established constitutional practices that Joseph had ignored.
So you have, in that respect, a reaffirmation of the status of the estates, their role in the Habsburg state overall. So in some respects, it's triumphal, and yet then they go through this unprecedented experience with the wars of the Revolutionary Era and the Napoleonic Wars, and they're not as healthy when they emerge out of that. Basically, at that point, you're ending your study because the estates are no longer as vital, and their days are really numbered.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, the estates resume the role that they had taken in the Seven Years' War, Maria Theresa's reign, and even partly in Joseph's reign, in the sense that they are meet on a yearly basis. They approve the yearly tax. They approve the tax request that comes down from the central government. They, with their own administrative structures, impose and collect the taxes in Lower Austria, and most importantly, again, they're providing enormous amounts of credit to the central government. It was another if one high point of this credit activity of the estates was in the Seven Years' War, and the next high point was in the Coalition Wars of the 1790s, where what they're doing, in order for people to understand what this credit activity was, I should explain it a little bit. In the earlier period, in the late 17th century, when the estates are loaning money to the central government, what is basically happening is that the nobility and the clergy, the wealthy nobility and clergy that belong to the estates, then loan money to the estates as a corporation, and it's fed up to the central government. Now, over the course of the 18th century, and this is one of the ways that the estates change under this fiscal military pressure from the 1650s onward. It's not like they stay the same. They're also changing. And what happens during Maria Theresa's reign is that the estates then start absorbing or start their credit activity starts to take in larger a broader section of the population, partly because they're imposing forced loans on the population during wartime, and then feeding this money up to the government. But what happens is that you also in peacetime after the Seven Years' War, you have women, you have common people, you have common soldiers, peasants loaning their money to the estates. And it's then gets fed into this system. And this is still going on during the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars. The estates are sustaining the war effort of the Habsburg monarchy, and this goes up until 1814, 1815. The reason I end the story there is because the Habsburg monarchy is not involved in a war again until 1848, and at that time the estates disappear. But the estates basically retain their significance for tax collection, for the administration of state debt, and in other ways up through the Revolutionary Napoleonic period.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I want to look at this problem that I've been trying to explain during this interview, that the Habsburg monarchy is a fiscal military state. I'm working on a volume looking at the entire monarchy. I mean, what I've done that, because I mean, it's a question of the languages that you can read and whatnot, Czech and Hungarian. But and so I'm working on this with a colleague, and it's going to be a volume called The Habsburg Monarchy as a Fiscal Military State, 1650 to 1815, Contours and Perspectives. And what we're doing, we've asked someone to look at Hungary, we've asked someone to look at Bohemia, to see and to look at all levels of the administration. Someone will be looking at a manorial structure. Someone will be looking at the Hungarian estates, and someone will be looking at towns and whatnot. How did this fiscal military pressure impact on all levels of Habsburg society and government? That's the question behind the volume, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, it sounds like a very thorough approach to a very complex issue.
Yeah, it's pretty complex.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Okay, thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.